intersections are those times when we have multiple choices for the direction that we will take, and then we have to decide. This podcast will explore the many intersections in people's lives. Some are pleasant, others are hair-raising, all are important. I'm Brett Dickerson, your host. In today's episode, I visit with Paula Sophia, a retired Oklahoma City police officer who had some meaningful intersections while serving in that important role. But her career was not like most men and women who serve Oklahoma City in that capacity. The first half of her career was as the award-winning male officer, Paul Schonauer, and then the last half as the female officer, Paula Sophia. I used to see you around here in Bricktown, riding a bike around here in Bricktown, as an Oklahoma City police officer, is that
yes.
right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
How many years were you with the Oklahoma City Police Department?
22 years.
22 years.
Right to the day.
Really?
Yes.
So after 22 years, what made you decide to, did you retire? I mean, could you retire at that point? Or did
I
you?
Did, yeah. Okay. Police officers presently, this may change in the near future, mm-hmm. But presently, police officers can retire with a pension at 20 years.
20 years, all right.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of like the military. Then.
Yeah, kind of like the military. Kind of they don't have to, but it is an option.
Mm-hmm.
And I never intended to have a real long career in the police department. I was looking at, from the very beginning, doing 20 to 25 years.
Right.
And hopefully being able to move on to do something new, and and my interests were toward academia at the time, and mostly still it is still that way.
Now Paula, you haven't always been known by the name Paula Sophia, have you?
No, that's what I changed my name to about 15 years ago, well, 13 years ago officially.
Mm-hmm. What was your name prior?
Paul.
Paul.
Yeah.
And you identified as a man earlier on in your life.
Yeah, I was assigned male at birth.
Right.
Yeah. And began my transition from male to female in November of 2000.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So 15 years ago.
So was that a kind of a series of decisions for you then to do that?
It growing into an understanding of my identity, mm-hmm. of trying to have identity integration,
mm-hmm.
and working very hard to be an authentic person.
Mm-hmm.
That came to a crisis point in my early 30s, and I spent a few years wondering what I was going to do about it, and finally I decided to transition.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've only known you as Paula. I mean, the whole time that we've known each other, I never knew you as it was Paul Schonauer, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I've only seen archived news reports and things at the time. I think the Oklahoman wrote a few profiles of you, didn't they?
Yeah, I guess I didn't know I was cutting edge at the time.
You're just working on your own stuff, weren't you? You weren't trying to be cutting edge.
Well, I became interested in community policing early in my career.
Yes.
I really got tired of patrolling around the neighborhood and people scowling at me in certain neighborhoods. And I thought, you know, there's a better way to do this.
Yeah.
And so I started waving at people.
Mm-hmm.
And when they started waving back, I started getting out and talking to people on voluntary contacts and then getting to know people in the neighborhoods that I would work. And then early in 1994, there was this project that Beverly Hodges, then the Ward 6 mm-hmm. Councilwoman from the Oklahoma City Council, developed Class and Beautiful.
Yeah.
And they requested a dedicated Class and unit.
Okay.
And which an officer would be assigned to that area and only be in that area, and be to curtail some of the crime problems. Mm-hmm. There's a big gang presence in the Classen corridor between 23rd and 36th at the time. There was a high crime rate, mm-hmm. and they wanted an officer to facilitate the Classen Beautiful project to also work on curtailing the criminal problems. And it was kind of like an early version of Weed and Seed in a way, functionally. Yeah. I mean, that was a federal program, but I saw that as an opportunity to put community policing ideas that I was developing in action, and it turned out to be a transformative experience, and it set the tone for the rest of my career as a police officer.
Wow! So, what were the five main, or maybe the top two things that you learned? Of course, it sounds like you were already dissatisfied with being a police officer that only got out of his car when something was wrong, when you're about to make an arrest or you're interviewing somebody. You wanted to interact with people.
I did. Because
you know, that you were just always that way, so you were a good fit for that Classen patrol van, right?
I hope so. I think I was, you know. I was. It was,
yeah.
I got a lot of recognition from the police department and some quite a few community awards that fill up a wall.
Yes.
I was well liked and respected. It really set the tone for the kind of work I've been doing since in a lot of ways, not just in law enforcement and politics, but the way that my aspirations. And one of the reasons that I'm in the Master of Social Work program now at OU, I had the opportunity to slow down and not have to go call to call all the time.
Right.
The technology is a wonderful thing. We have police cars and radios and computers, but sometimes technology is alienating.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to a restaurant and see people sitting with their smartphones and no one's talking to each other. They're texting and using social media on their smartphones. Well, there's been that element that challenges law enforcement because, they're going from one thing to another, crisis after crisis.
Right.
They're often not able to get to know the communities that they're serving very well. And that's some of that's by design, some of that's by default, because I think a lot of police departments nationally hire the number of officers that they do based on how they respond to call volume.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting quantity of police work, but you're not getting quality of police work. So my volunteering to be a dedicated Classen unit was an emphasis on trying to get a quality police work.
Right.
I found that doing community policing is that there's an exchange in the community that if an officer is able to make him or herself become a resource for the community and builds up some trust, that community will then, tell the officer what problems that they're having and direct the officer to some very interesting things. I didn't ever have a problem with getting the activity that I needed to get to look like a productive police officer.
Yeah.
But I didn't have to, what they call bad rap people. You know, it's when you bad rap someone, you put them in jail for, something marginal.
Right.
Or you put them in jail for something that they may not, be prosecuted for.
Do you, just to make a point. Do you find that when that happens, do you find, as somebody who really was in tune with the community, when a community believes that people are being arrested for things that they would not be arrested for maybe in some other community, does that just fester? Does it just build up over time and just make things worse and worse.
Well, sometimes, and you don't know this unless you really know the community you're serving as a police officer, but making an arrest, though it would be perfectly legal to do so, is not always the best choice. There's other more creative things that can be done to help a community resolve an issue. Because a lot of times officers are like referees.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you really are, aren't you?
Yeah, you know, and sometimes that, you know, it's necessary to take someone to the penalty box.
You know? Yes, yes.
But really, sometimes it's not, arrest isn't the first choice. Yeah. Isn't the best choice, I should say. It's often the first choice, but it's not the best choice.
Yes.
And I think it's a philosophy. How do you quantify what a police officer does?
Right.
The way that people quantify it is through statistics, number of arrests, number of tickets, number of contacts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And I think that's just one dimension.
Mm-hmm.
I really kind of feel like if you're really working as a police officer, those things are going to come anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But focusing on only those things and deciding, the whole focus of criminal justice is not on arresting people. It's about keeping the peace.
Yeah, and that's a big difference, isn't it? Locking people up is not the same thing as keeping the peace.
That's right. Sometimes locking people up, it doesn't allow people to resolve a conflict, and then just by virtue of pressing the charge and having someone go to jail, which is really a humiliating experience, and one that really creates a lot more enmity between people.
Yeah.
And so it's not always the best choice. Often it is the necessary thing. Officers don't have discretion in some situations.
Sure.
But sometimes when there is discretion, defaulting to an arrest mode, I think can be very harmful.
Yeah. Well, because if two guys are fighting, the issue that they started fighting about in the first place ain't going to go away just because one of them gets locked up for 30 days, right?
That's right.
When he gets out, there's still going to be a problem between those two people, isn't there?
Often there is.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Making the arrest, you know, it's not a choice, because if the fight it results in someone being injured bad enough, there's an aggravated issue.
Yeah.
There isn't much discretion in that. But when it's just a little, you know, fisticuffs and, you know, more bruised egos than anything else, you know, if the officer has time, sometimes there's a better way to resolve that. And get people together.
Yeah. My point on that was that just arresting somebody doesn't solve a problem.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, it solves an immediate problem where if somebody feels threatened or, you know, somebody feels like they're in danger, getting that guy out of their presence is very important. It's what we depend upon the police to do. But what you're saying is, though, that might be necessary, but it's not the whole of keeping the peace.
No, not at all. Domestic abuse, though, is a place where, especially in order to do everything to protect the victim.
Right.
I most often did make that arrest.
Sure.
By state statute and city ordinance, had any charge in a domestic abuse situation, that person went to jail.
Yeah.
Because that buys the victim time to leave, buys the victim time to get shelter or support, and to get out of that abuse situation. Mm-hmm. So that's one place where, if to whatever degree that I had any justification, that person went to jail. And honestly, in domestic abuse situations, I didn't have a problem taking someone to jail.
Well, there's such a big power differential there, isn't there? There's just, you know, between a man who's beating up his wife, for example,
uh-huh.
or just one partner that's more powerful, physically powerful than another one.
Yeah.
That almost has to happen, doesn't it? Just to give the other person time and space to figure out what to do next.
Right? You really have to mm-hmm. be the victim's advocate mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. a domestic abuse situation
right.
because it's not just that one incident. It's a cycle. Mm-hmm. It's a dynamic.
Yeah.
And as much intervention as a police can make, they're encouraged to make and, mm-hmm. and very often and most often do.
Right.
Unfortunately, we hear about incidences where the system broke down, but most often officers are very conscientious about mm-hmm. about protecting the victim. Including myself, whatever I could do to
right.
protect the victim, I did.
Right. Now, let me kind of shift here a little bit because you, probably the most fascinating thing to me when I read your story several years back was that you spent kind of one half of your career with the public seeing you as a male police officer and then the last half of your career as a female police officer,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
That to me, that was probably the most unique thing about it. People, seems like the public has gotten accustomed to, and for the most part, accepting of female police officers. But you had the unique experience of being of the public seeing you as a male officer and then as a female officer. What were the differences in the way people reacted to you when you presented yourself as a police officer, somebody didn't already know you? What were the biggest differences that you saw, or did you see any at all?
Oh, yeah, quite a big difference. Initially, it was really frustrating because people don't listen to women in authority as readily as they do men in authority.
You were used to them listening to you.
Oh, right? Yeah. I mean, I was this big white guy.
You're a big guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I said, you know, this is what's going on and this is what's going to happen, generally it did.
Yeah.
And so going out there and presenting as female, I wasn't immediately listened to. And so I had to employ a lot more patience. Mm-hmm. And some different tactics, because I couldn't just be blustery and authoritative. Mm-hmm. I had to be more engaging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, let's take time and talk this out. And as much as I could, I was already kind of naturally inclined to do that anyway.
Well,
so,
yeah.
But it wasn't. It was a little frustrating because it just didn't happen right away. And so it took me a while to adjust.
Yeah.
I think a lot of women understand that dynamic where, you know, they work very hard and then their male colleagues are working and then the male colleagues get the majority of the credit, you know, or get more listened to more immediately. Mm-hmm. Like a woman in a office situation will. Hey, I have this idea, and then oh yeah, that's great. And then a man in the same meeting even
yeah.
will say, hey, this idea. Say the
yeah,
same
yeah.
thing the woman said. Oh yeah, that's great, Joe. You know, that's frustrating.
Yeah,
yeah. That was the most immediate difference that I experienced.
So you really saw that out on the street. Did it give you a different view of what the female officers that you'd been working with all those years, what the difference was?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I was like, gosh, girl, you've been putting up with a lot.
Yeah. 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 So, and you're still a tall person, still impressive physical presence. Now as you were then, identifying as a male officer, but yet because you were a female officer, people just automatically assume that you really weren't quite the authority that they had assumed earlier on when they were talking to Officer Paul.
Yes, right? That's exactly.
Wow.
That was
That's amazing.
Probably one of the biggest adjustments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of people ask you, it seems like all of these, well, the few interviews that I've read where the papers interviewed you, they were mostly just really fascinated with the fact that you had been a man and now you want to be a woman. But for me, the issue was, wow, you're in the same environment. You're doing the same work, first as a man and now as a woman. What are the differences? So you saw some big differences then in just the way people accepted you.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And it took a while. Mm-hmm. One of the good things, though, is that I was able to work the same area of town that I worked before. Uh-huh. And, you know, during my time as dedicated class and unit, I developed a lot of goodwill with the community. Mm-hmm. And when I came out and I transitioned, quite a few of those folks gave me the benefit of the doubt. Mm. Now, if I'd been a tyrant as a police officer, I don't think I would have got that tolerance.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of a karmic cycle had
already earned a lot of that kind of respect to start with.
I think so. Yeah. Some people like, what is up with you? And I'd talk to them and, you know, they'd seen stuff like about transgender people on Oprah Winfrey show. And, and okay, I've heard about that before. And it was an opportunity to talk. And so people gave me the benefit of the doubt. And because I'd created a lot of goodwill. Mm-hmm. Had I not been able to stay in the same district, I think I would have had a lot more trouble.
It just sounded like to me, I'm just checking my own perceptions here. It sounded like to me that the Oklahoma City Police Department itself really came through on that. They didn't drum up some kind of reason to push you out or anything like that. Certainly there were probably personalities in the police department that had a hard time with that whole transition. But at the end of the day, your especially command allowed you to go right back to that same district and to still be a patrol officer, didn't they?
Yeah. I think if there was some element of it that they let me go back out there so I'd have enough rope to hang myself. I think there was an element of that. I didn't, though.
Yeah.
We had our problems. Mm-hmm. Some of them really bad, but the department made mistakes, but so did I. Mm-hmm. I did. I was adjusting to myself and trying to find my authentic persona, and then dealing with all the pressure of the fallout from a divorce and having to move to a new residence and dealing with issues at my church. You know, it was a really stressful time, and I know that I made mistakes here and there with my colleagues, and they made some mistakes. But ultimately, though, we were able to come to an understanding, and I had the opportunity to continue working. And over time, people realized that, Paula's still working hard. And I tell you what, I've learned Oklahomans they're very conservative, but they're also very fair-minded. Mm-hmm. And if you're willing to get out there and work hard, they give you a lot of consideration.
Yeah.
And even though I never had the complete understanding and even support in some ways of my colleagues, they respected at least that. Mm-hmm. And that's how I was able to keep going. And when I did retire, it was on good terms. It was a very positive thing, and I didn't leave over something bitter and that was what I wanted from the very beginning, was to be able to leave honorably.
Right.
And I was able to do that, and the police department was able to let me do that. And I have to give a lot of credit to Chief City.
Yeah.
for that. He was very patient with me on a couple occasions. we had some pretty intense meetings a few times. Mm-hmm. I also have to give a lot of credit to a lot of the my colleagues I worked around. They were adjusting, I was adjusting, and ultimately it's a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
And not without it's fraught full moments, but mm-hmm. I feel very positive about how things happened. And I'm glad that I was able to move on when I did.
Mm-hmm.
I still have friends in the police department who I respect. And I know that the culture right now and we're looking at the way that police departments operate and being critical, and I think we need to be. We have nationally, we have a lot of departments that have stretched their resources very thin, and they're putting a lot of stress on their police officers to handle situations on very meager manpower and budgets, and mm-hmm. not with a lot of latitude on what choices that they make. And then we don't emphasize enough about the importance of letting officers patrol their districts mm-hmm. and be proactive instead of just reactive.
Right.
I'm certainly not an advocate for a police state. But we need to look at how to do this different.
And that has to, that really has to do with just how many people are out there on the street, doesn't it? If you take the Los Angeles approach to things, which is to stretch manpower as far as you can go, and just then you have officers that just race from one call to another
mm-hmm.
in and out of one neighborhood after another they haven't had time to get to know, right?
That's right.
Maybe they know the street grid, and that's about it. And knowing people or people knowing them, that's really critical to keeping the peace, isn't it? Is for people to know, or at least somebody in the crowd to know this police officer, to know you from... you know, to know you to be a fair police officer, doesn't it?
Yeah. There's some risk in that. You know, I was criticized as working the way that I did as being mm-hmm. officer friendly, and mm-hmm. you know what, you're really exposing yourself and mm-hmm. and to getting taken out.
Mm-hmm.
I always had the opposite attitude. It's like, wait, if I'm someone that they know personally,
mm-hmm.
they're less likely to take me out.
Right.
But if I'm just a uniform,
yeah.
It's a lot easier to hate something that's monolithic.
Right.
And lacking dimension and lacking humanity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I not only wanted to understand the people that I served and their humanity, but I hoped that they would understand my humanity and we'd have that agreement. And I think in assignments that I had where I was able to have the time to develop a relationship mm-hmm. with people, I was able to achieve that. And I think officers are safer if they have a real relationship with the communities they serve. I know as a transgender woman that, you know, there's people that are opposed to the idea of transgender people at all, but when they get to know me personally, you know, their attitudes start to change. Because why? Because they know someone personally. I'm right there and they're getting to know me. Same as a police officer.
Yeah, so you really learned that being a police officer, and now you bring it to your students now and you bring it to other people you know now that it really is important to keep getting to know people who are different than you are, isn't it?
Yeah, it takes effort.
If all of the transgender people in Oklahoma City all just relate to each other and don't really get to know other people,
yeah.
That doesn't help, does it?
No, it doesn't. Yeah. We live in a society right now that we get in our own echo chambers.
That's right.
And we shout and shout and shout mm-hmm. and we hear ourselves and mm-hmm. and the people that are like-minded and we have our our social media, and we delete people that we disagree with us, and and we only associate with people that agree with us, and I think that's been damaging, and yes. We only have to look at our United States Congress and, you know, the House of Representatives and the Senate,
yes,
and see how entrenched everybody is to see the damage of living in an echo chamber, not being able to talk with people, not being able to negotiate things. You know, life after I transitioned was a constant negotiation. Yeah. Really, it was.
Yeah.
Because I was having to overcome people's prejudice or ignorance more often.
Right.
And create a space where I could at least be treated professionally as a colleague. Yeah. And then dealing with citizens, if I offered respect, as much as I offered respect, that was usually what I got back. Mm-hmm. So that was a negotiation, and that's a negotiation for any police officer.
Yeah.
So I think we need to step out of our echo chambers, have some of these uncomfortable conversations. You know, it's interesting, your show is called Intersections. Mm-hmm. And we talk a lot in academic circles about intersectionality right now,
yeah.
You know, different things that people are dealing with that offer them privilege,
right.
Intersections that offer them privilege, or intersections that offer them where they find themselves more oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do think we need to step into those intersections, have these hard conversations, and be willing to be vulnerable, because that's what happens when you're having hard conversations. With the attitude, though, that we need to be respectful. And that's something that in our echo chambers we're forgetting how to do, is be respectful.
All right. Well, Paula Sophia, thank you very much for joining us today. This has been a great interview, a great conversation, and much luck to you in your master's degree program that you're working
on. Thank you.
That's a lot of hard work.
Yes, it is. And
yes, it is. So thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate that.
All right. Thank you.
That concludes the interview. Thank you for listening. This podcast idea came from taking a hard look at the many intersections in my life and listening to the intersections that other people talk about in their own lives. I want to hear about your intersections. My email address is ideas@intersectionsok.com. You can also communicate with me on Twitter and Instagram @intersectionsok. Also, take a look at the website at intersectionsok.com. Steven Tyler is the producer, and I am your host, Brett Dickerson.